Welcome to On the Mark with Peter Buckley and Mark O'Donnell. Our podcast is dedicated to helping Christians target the right priorities in their apostolic and interior lives.
Hello and welcome back once again to On the Mark. I want to welcome and thank all of you for joining us. I want to particularly thank Mark O'Donnell for being with us. I am Peter Buckley, serving as your host, but I, of course, want to bring the star of the show, Mark, on. Mark O'Donnell, welcome.
Thanks, Peter. It's great to be here. I'm sorry we haven't recorded in a while, but I guess just a lot of things came up in the interim, so it's good to be back.
Yeah, for sure. And actually a very appropriate time to be discussing today's topic, which is one of the virtues. And it's really not just a discussion of the virtue in a general way, but how we can apply this to really, I guess, our main theme over the past several episodes, which is this notion of evangelizing in the workplace. And so the focus today will be on the virtue of temperance. And particularly, we want to use as a reference point, Pope Francis has been going through with his general audiences a series on the virtues, and this was the final one. It was the virtue of temperance. We'll include a copy of that. It's very short and very good. A copy of the Pope Francis's comments on temperance, which we'll be discussing today. And it was very good. If you follow the series from Pope Francis, it seems as though the perspective he has on this virtue, as he has on others, seems to be unique to him, and I think very, very, very good one. So let's get right into it. So, Mark, what is this temperance, and why, I guess, of all the verses, does it seem to be so misunderstood?
That's a good point. I think we can take the definition right from the catechism that Pope Francis quoted in that audience, which we'll include in the show notes. And it says, quote, temperance is a moral virtue that moderates the attraction of pleasures and provides balance in the use of created goods. So it's kind of an internal regulator of sorts. It's, you know, think of it like a thermostat. You know, when things get too cold, you've got to, you know, turn the heat up, you know, so you can function well. And when things get too hot, you have to pull it down. Well, a lot of our moods and emotions are that way. And this thermostat is the virtue that we're trying. You know, that's a non-theological crude analogy, but I think it helps people to kind of envision it, because they all know what it's like when things get too hot or too cold. I think it gets a bad rap just because of the historically the you know, the temperance movement, prohibition era. There's a rich history about that in our country, and you know, there were a lot of people had to struggle with alcohol because there was no other distractions, and so there was a movement to ban alcohol so that these individuals, mostly men and fathers and working men, could be better fathers and better working men. But I think in the process, you know, people got the impression that, you know, it was kind of the nanny police were watching out. And so when you bring up the virtue, people think of it as kind of, you know, a little bit, you know, a do-gooder. Somebody who tries to live temperance is a do-gooder and doesn't want to kind of put the pedal to the metal anytime. And that's not really understanding the virtue. One of the interesting points in what Pope Francis talks about is he says, you know, sometimes we need to be corrected. And it's hard to correct somebody. He says that's the hardest thing that we have to do in our lives. I agree with that. You know, to make a fraternal correction to somebody about a thing they're not doing right takes a lot of courage to do that. But it's much better to do that, he says, than to kind of give into this rancorous silence where we just kind of fester and become bitter. And that doesn't help anybody. So there's an example where temperance is an act of strength and courage to kind of stand up and say, hey, you know, you have to stop doing this. It's really annoying a lot of people. Then I'll help you and pray for you and leave it at that.
Seems like this is a very good governor, as you're describing, the analogy of the thermometer in our personal lives. But why practice this virtue in the context of evangelizing, evangelization?
Well, I think it helps us all over the place. The more I think about the virtue, and Pope Francis mentions this, he mentions this whole virtue of reliability. Reliability is tied into temperance. You know, that we can't be reliable in our jobs and our relationships if we're intemperate. you know, for heavy drinkers or gamblers or if we're addicted to pornography. You know, I mean, it reminds me of when I was working years ago at Allied Signal at a manufacturing operation. You know, it was mostly men there, but there were a fair number of women. But one of the problems they had in the organization was that people were looking at too much pornography on their business computers, and they were buying too many things from Amazon. So at one of the sales meetings, they just announced, look, you got to stop doing this. If you don't, then we're just going to take your browser off your computer so you can use it for email, but you can't use it for anything else. And it was pretty amazing, kind of the shift. And I remember one gentleman who was working there, he came up to me and said, you know, I think I'm just going to get my browser removed because every once in a while I'm tempted, you know. And so he went to the head of IT, and the head of IT said, well, look, why don't you just see if you can do it for a week or two. And then if it's a real problem, we'll remove the browser, but let's not jump at that. And that's all it took. And the guy was able to kind of get focused on work and get back to business. So, you know, he was more reliable. Everybody was more reliable and more efficient in that situation. So there's a good use of the virtue. I think it also helps us to manage our anger. There's no question about that. That's our strongest passion. We have to rein that in. We have to channel that in the right direction. I mean, there is a good anger. Our Lord got angry with the scribes and Pharisees, and those are some real, you know, down and dirty fights. There's no question about it. They're right there in Scripture. And sometimes, you know, there's, you know, a justifiable anger, but a lot of times there isn't, or we can't control it because it's so strong. And then it can destroy us or destroy others. I remember when I was investing with one of my former clients in a business deal, and I caught him cheating. I was pretty angry with him. And I remember I was talking to my advisor from Schwab, and I was telling him about it. And he looked at me and he said, well, why are you still working with the guy? And I said, well, I may be able to get his listing to sell his house down the road. And he looked at me and he laughed and said, look, just cut it off. Okay, this is going to fester in you. Just cut it off. Get away from them. Forget about the house. Move on. You can't work with people like that. It really helped me. It's like, whoa, that was good. You know, I mean, and so that's a case where, you know, I was able to kind of cut out the anger early. And then just managing our egos, you know, we all have a tendency just to talk about ourselves, to be kind of conversational narcissists. You know, there's one phrase called, not, you know, don't be a topper. You know, topper is someone who always tops the story you tell. You know, that you got stuck in traffic for an hour, and then they say, well, I was stuck for 4 hours. And it's like, okay, I guess I'm done talking about that. You know, and without even realizing, you know, the kind of the egoism in that, and just his incapacity to listen. And so temperance helps us do that. You know, we can temper our speech. We can temper our ego. We can temper our anger. Yeah, so I think it's a really interesting virtue.
Those are great examples and really great insights. I guess when we think about the virtue, we're, I think, more inclined to think of some of the things we've discussed, you know, trying to renounce excessive use of alcohol and gambling and those kind of things. But you talked about, or you mentioned talking about ourselves, but there's also other means by which we can exercise this virtue. And I think you just touched on a little bit of it in this whole notion about talking about others and gossip. Maybe expand upon that a bit and other ways that we can live the virtue more effectively in the workplace.
Well, in terms of gossip, I think that's a really important area because most of the time we're not even aware of our sins against charity, you know, rash judgment and gossip and sullenness toward others and so forth. And I remember when I was about 10 years ago, I had to make a trip to New Jersey or I had to go to Washington, actually, to visit my family. Stopped in New Jersey, and I get a call or a text from one of my real estate clients who wants to look at a house in Quincy because he may want to buy it. And I can't show the house, right, because I'm down in Princeton. And so I call one of my colleagues, a woman named Barbara. And she said, yeah, I'll take care of it. You go to Washington. I'll show them the house. If they want to make an offer, we'll take care of it. I said, well, I can pay you a referral fee. She says, no, don't worry about it. You'll be back Monday. Just relax. So sure enough, they made an offer. It was accepted. You know, I came back. We had the home inspection. We bought it. And a couple of years later, someone was, you know, trash talking Barbara. And he asked me what I thought of her. And I just brought up that story. I said, you know, I don't know. Maybe she, you know, maybe she is what you're saying. But I had a really good experience with her. And she helped me. And that just stopped the whole conversation, you know, and stopped the gossip, like right in its tracks. So I think that's a good way to live this virtue is to help other people temper their gossip and, you know, tendency we have to drag others down.
I hate to be a topper here, but I also.
Good. No, this is good.
I also have a Barbara story. Believe it or not. And also it centers in this whole notion of gossip. So Barbara. I was at an investment firm, and Barbara worked for the managing partner of the firm. And we were younger then, and, you know, we would go out on, you know, different weekend nights or, you know, Thursday evenings. And so it was a bunch of, you know, brokers. And so there wasn't a lot of regulating the discussion. A lot of it had to do with, you know, did you hear about John did this versus this? And, you know, the whole bit. And there was a lot of discussion about people in the office and those types of things. And then this woman, Barbara, would occasionally come up. Barbara G, she had a very long Italian name. She would occasionally come out with us. And of course, she knew everything. She was the source of all these conjectures. And and she kept her mouth shut so impressively. And that's probably 30 years ago that I worked with this woman, and she still is, I regard her as one of the more professional people I've ever been around because of that little delicacy of her not engaging in gossip in any way. And it was very impressive. So there's my topper for you.
That's a great story.
Barbara G. Yeah.
I mean, temperance helps us to be silent. I also remember, the whole Me Too movement when I was working in New York City in the 1980s, you know, and, you know, there was a fully integrated workplace, you know, men and women working together side by side. And there's so many beautiful women that, you know, I was working with. And I was just wondering, gee, how do people restrain themselves here? And it turns out they really weren't. We found out later, you know, when Me Too hit. But I remember when I was in the convenience store business, I sold that business to a guy who was working at a adult video store, you know, and he didn't really like that business, understandably. But, and he said, you know, he said, the people that come in here, they're just not normal. At first I thought they were, but they're really not. There's something really wrong with them. And I don't really want to be around that environment. And so he bought the store I had from me and ran it with his wife for a number of years. And I felt kind of good that, hey, I was able to actually help someone get out of a intemperate situation. But also, I just found it intriguing to have some empirical data about the actual impact that this would have on people who were watching it, you know. And now we know a lot more about it. And we know, you know, it can cause tremendous harm to people, not only morally, but also just you know, physically and mentally. So that's where temperance comes in. You know, how do you control your lust? And then lastly, I'd say it just helps us control our greed, which is a powerful force inside of us. I remember the last time I was laid off from corporate, I was at a company called IDC, and it was a standard layoff. I mean, there were probably 30 people getting sacked that day, right? And I was one of them. And I remember asking the HR woman, I said, well, how did you guys come to this decision? And she said, well, numbers were down because this is 2001 after the internet crash, right? And we went to senior management and we said, look, we can keep running the business the way we're doing it. If you give up your bonuses for the end of the year, we can keep all these people on, you know, for another whatever, a year or whatever. And she said, and they didn't want to do that. So Yeah, I mean, I'm not, you know, but it's just interesting to me. It was like, I wonder how long a discussion that was, you know, about, you know, should we keep 30 people or keep our bonus?
Yeah.
I mean, and I'm sure that's typical everywhere, but that's, you know, temperance helps us to, you know, labor is more important than capital, right? That's the church social doctrine. I mean, not that that was going to enter into that discussion, but temperance could have helped those people to say, hey, look, you know, we're already getting paid a good salary. We should just stick with it, try to get the business back on track and so forth and so on. Now, I don't know all the details, so I'm probably not the right, I'm not, you know, really able to judge here, but that's just an example, I think.
And yeah, so maybe focusing on that, Mark, I mean, this whole sense of covetousness and greed, very strong passions, and but in their examples in the Gospels, maybe just touch on, you know, one or two of those, you know, the parable of the rich fool, the rich man and Lazarus.
Yeah, well, I think the rich man of Lazarus is interesting because the rich man doesn't strike me as a bad guy. You know, when he's in Gehenna, he's asking Abraham to go back to his brothers. He's got five brothers, and tell them not to do what I did, so they don't end up here. So that's already an act of charity, right? Because most people who are in hell, well, everyone who's technically in hell can't practice charity anymore. So maybe he's in some type of purgatory, or we don't know exactly what it is, but it's not comfortable. But the thing that struck me most about that is that he just didn't know about Lazarus. He didn't have an opinion about him, but he wasn't aware of his existence and his plight because he was too busy living his lifestyle. I mean, it kind of hits home for me. I know people who've been laid off from work, right? And I try to help them get jobs. But, you know, maybe I got to send them a check, you know, and just keep my mouth shut and say, hey, you know, here's 10 grand. I know you're going to need it. I'm not saying, you know, at some point it has to hit us a little bit deeper, I think, for it to be genuine. You know, and maybe that 10 grand can bridge somebody for 2 or 3 months on a, you know, on a mortgage, and that's enough to get them back up into the workforce again. Who knows? But I think it has to go a little bit deeper than just, you know, just the surface, and it has to hurt us a little bit. And when we do that, I think it helps our families because we're not that mission focused on the workplace. I mean, from all I can tell, most of the evangelization I hear about is mostly with families, right? We want to have good schools where the kids can be brought up well. You know, we want to have good activities that are safe, that are wholesome. We want them to have the good spiritual formation they need. But why are we doing all of that? We're doing all of that to prepare people to enter into the workplace where it's going to be hand-to-hand combat. I mean, I hate to be blunt about it, but it is. It's hand-to-hand combat. But that's our call as lay people. We shouldn't be afraid of it. You know, we shouldn't be afraid that we're in, you know, morally toxic environments. And we should try to protect ourselves, but also have that influence on those environments, be an example to people who are there so that they can actually see somebody who's actually trying to live this. Because otherwise they just hear about it and the media is their only source. And the media is going to, you know, they've got their narrative, which is not supportive of morality by and large. And they need to see you. They need to see me. They need to see us actually trying to, they need to see Barbara, who keeps her mouth shut. And now 30 years later, you know, the positive impact is still there.
You mentioned the work environment, both Pope Francis in this particular document and also his predecessor, Pope Benedict, talk a lot about the environment. I mean, you know, we're Mother Nature, you know. So how do we work that into this whole discussion of temperance? Care for the environment.
Well, I think, and this is Pope Benedict in Salt of the Earth. He's got a couple of pages where he talks about the real failure of the environmental movement is that it just looks at the external environment, the material environment. It doesn't look at the internal environment of the human being, of the man and woman. And we don't care about the pollution of that environment. But it's precisely the pollution of our internal environments that causes the pollution of the external environment. And I think that that's true in the workplace as well as in just the general environment, you know, environmental movement where people litter or they just leave crap all around or they, you know, they pour oil into the rivers or what have you. You know, that happens just because of internally we've already been, we've been polluted. And in that internal environment is where temperance helps us so much so that we don't become polluted and then we don't go out and become polluters around us, you know. And that's a very good, those couple pages, we might want to think about just putting those in the show notes. I'll try to dig that out of Salt of the Earth. Mm-hmm. It's a brilliant, you know, as only Pope Benedict can do in like three paragraphs, he sums up the whole topic. But it's a good way to explain it to people, I think, you know, and it's a good way to elevate the conversation beyond just, you know, we want more trees and more green and we want to solve global warming. Okay. Well, we really don't want, you know, that all starts with stop polluting in a variety of ways to the extent that we can. But that's what we want to focus on. You know, we can't, that we can control that. We can't control what cows do or what, you know, the oceans do. Mm-hmm. We may think we can, but we really don't have as much control over that as we do over ourselves. And that's what temperance is, this whole idea of self-control, self-mastery, mm-hmm. you know, and that's why the virtue is so important. And it also should give people like hope that, hey, I can actually do this. This is something I can do. Yeah, that's great. That's a great way to think about it, I think, you know, because then you don't feel helpless in the face of, you know, the changes that are happening, you know, whatever you want, however you want to call it, describe it. I think there's a lot of frustration there, you know.
Let's tear you away from your tree hugging here for a minute and get back to the virtue as temperance as we're applying it to this notion of evangelization, both in the workplace, but also perhaps in family life as well, home life.
Well, I think it's clearly important, right, in our personal relationships, right? And Pope Francis talks about that at home, you know, try not to throw dishes at each other. And if you do, then make up and say you're sorry. You know, he has a way of saying things. He didn't say it in that handout, but he said it previously. I mean, he's aware of the difficulties that intimacy brings with it, you know, and that is it can bring out the best in us as well as the worst, unfortunately. And so we have to be very careful of that because we can be very hurtful to others in our language and our behaviors. So it starts there. But then the whole point of it is that we want the word of God to come alive within us so that we can go out and talk to others about God in some way, whatever's the right way, you know, through our witness and our words. And you'll discover that if you're living temperance, and then you'll go out and you'll do what Barbara did. You know, you'll be there and maybe you're praying for people who are gossiping and you're trying to get them off those topics onto something else. That's a great evangelization, just that simple presence, prayer, and then preaching in a way that's not really, they don't even notice it. They don't even realize it. You know, you're not giving them some abrupt correction, although that could be deserved, but you're trying to bring out the best in others. You're trying to talk about their good points and help others to see, you know, because no one feels good after they've been gossiping, right? I mean, everyone feels awful. If you're a normal person, you feel awful. Yeah.
Maybe as we're getting towards the end here, Mark, as we do on most episodes, is to try to take what we've discussed in a broader, more general academic sense and make it more tangible and practical. So what are some specific or practical ways to live this well?
Well, you know, manage your intakes, your food and your drink. I mean, I think now we know about the risk of alcohol, right? They probably didn't in the Prohibition era, but now that's pretty well documented. Everybody knows that that's a very dangerous drug and it takes out a lot of people. And so to manage it yourself and to help others manage it, live in a schedule. You know, that entails some self-denial, temperance. Maybe you get up an hour earlier so you can complete your spiritual plan of life before the day starts, or most of it. Make an effort to greet people
No, that's an important point, by the way, Mark. I think you know there was when I was first meeting Opus Dei, and you know, for those who are not aware, there's this particular plan of life that we all strive to live, and you know, things that the church has lived for, you know, but since its beginning. And I remember this old, you know, guy who was kind of giving me some spiritual direction. He, you know, I started going through, well, I'm busy, I'm a young father, I'm working. And that was his point in terms of what you're saying about living a schedule. And this was, I'll maintain his anonymity, but it was Bob J with an English accent. And he said in his, you know, classic, abrupt British way, he said, look, you're just going to have to realize in order to do all these things well or do them at all, you just have to realize you have to get up an hour earlier than most people in the similar circumstance. So in your job with family and so forth. And that was something, thankfully, I recognized and adopted very early on. And he was right.
Yeah.
And it's because otherwise it can just seem overwhelming and insurmountable, but that's a pretty easy fix. And then, of course, if you're going to get up early, that requires a couple of other things. So I remember Father Rafael Camano, great priest, old Navy guy, and was pretty bottom line oriented. And he said, look, I mean, here are the three things you have to take care of. He said, you need to get, so if you want to get up early, of course, you have to go to bed appropriately. So he said, you have to go to bed on time, you have to get up on time, and you have to leave work on time. And you would think, you know, the most challenging of those was, you know, perhaps getting up on time. But he said, you know, for most, you know, professionals, you know, men or women, you know, it's a struggle to, you know, you're rushing out to get the, you know, 5 o'clock train or whatever, and you're chatting with the guy next to you and the kind of interesting conversation. Well, I'll get the 5:20. Well, it goes, then it's 5:40. So that can be one of the more challenging of those, is just leaving work in time. But I think those three simple guidelines, getting up on time, first of all, well, going to bed on time, getting up on time, and then leaving work on time, can really provide a very solid means of structure and good governing force in your daily life.
Definitely. Definitely. I mean, and I think you should schedule relaxation. You know, it just because you don't need to be a teetotaler. I mean, you could schedule, you know, hey, you know, every Saturday we're going to have a, you know, a special snack at home, and you can have a couple of beers, you know, or you're going to, you schedule it so that it doesn't kind of become something that's done outside and then it grows. I mean, it's much better to have two or three beers with people you know than to have six beers on your own, you know, while you're scrolling down, watching shorts on YouTube or whatever. I mean, or NFL reruns, yeah. You know? I mean, I remember when I was in a convenience store business, I know we're out of time here, but there was one of my suppliers was a guy from Eagle Snacks. Eagle Snacks owns Cape Cod potato chips. And so he would come and fill up the rack in my store, you know, once a week. And one day we were just talking, right, about, you know, life. And I said, so how you doing? He says, I'm doing it. And then he went on to share with me. He says, you know, I go home, you know, I grab a bite to eat, you know, I have a six pack, I fall asleep, and I get up the next day and I go do it again. And he was probably 35. You know, he probably weighed like 160 pounds because he was literally running all day long. But I mean, that kind of functioning alcoholism is probably not going to last, you know, for most people. Mm-hmm. You know, but that I think is not uncommon, you know, and I think rather than, you know, medicate yourself that way, obviously we would advocate building a spiritual life and building some friendships and having people help you and, you know, come to the means of formation that Opus Dei provides or other spiritual entities provide to help someone build a relationship with Jesus so that they're not dependent on that as a medicinal way to deal with, you know, the toxicity in their lives. Limit social media. I think that's the new challenge, really. I mean, Mike Rowe's got a lot of videos about this. He talks about all these unemployed men who aren't looking for jobs. And he says what they are doing is they're looking at screens 40 hours a week. And it's so easy to fall into that. And, you know, to be fair, there's a lot of good stuff that you can look at. There's no question about it. If you want to know how to, you know, change the plunger on your toilet, you can learn that on YouTube in like 10 minutes, probably, and you'll probably be able to do it. Or if you want to fix your shower door, you know, that type of thing, it's available there. As well as a lot of good educational stuff and a lot of good spiritual stuff. But it easily creeps up to the point where it just absorbs so much time, and then it weakens our capacity for praying, and that weakens our capacity for listening, and that weakens our capacity for loving other people. Because if you can listen well, you can love well, and you can be a great friend. And that's where your investment really should be, is in that, you know, rather than in just kind of being stimulated by. So that's kind of I think the thing that most of us have to fight with, that's pretty broad, and it's not necessarily evil per se, but it definitely can diminish our capacity, our fervor, and our love. The last thing I would just say is, you know, because we always try to tie in something from scripture that's going to help, right? And I was thinking about this. Well, who's really written about temperance? I mean, there's some parts in St. Paul where he talks about it, sure. But St. James, that epistle, I think is excellent. He talks about our passions and how our passions get out of control and how they, you know, can ruin us. And it's just a short epistle, but he is so good. You know, and it's, I would definitely read that and keep it front and center, and, you know, and just accept the fact that he's explaining something very clearly, and we should all be able to relate to it.
That's great. Great way to end it too. So thank you for that recommendation. We've mentioned a few documents that we can put in the show notes, but in the spirit of temperance, we're getting towards
exactly. Well said.
Our half hour here. So let's finish on time. So I want to thank you again, Mark, for sharing your insights and commentary. Appreciate it very much. And I want to thank everybody for joining us, and hope to see you once again back here on The Mark.
Awesome. Thanks, Peter.
Thanks for listening to On The Mark with Peter Buckley and Mark O'Donnell. If you enjoy our podcast, be sure to follow us on Apple Podcasts and Spotify to be notified every time Peter and Mark release a new episode. And visit us on the web at onthemark.show.